80 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
All right, greetings. Welcome to Media Matters this Sunday, April 3rd, 2011. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. We have as our guest today one of the great journalists of the last 50 years in the United States, someone whom Joan Didion has called one of the best reporters of our time. He'll be here with us for the whole hour talking about his career and his present work at Truth Dig. Robert Scheer, our guest for the full hour. Should be a wonderful time. I hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
There's an old saying in the news business, news is what gets wrapped around the advertisements. But some broadcasters have ignored the dividing line between news and ads, and it's going to cost them. For several years, TV newscasters have used a type of stealth commercial called a video news release, distributed by companies to sell their products, but made to look and sound just like a news item. It's legal to use them so long as they're identified as sponsored segments. This week, the Federal Communications Commission fined two stations for violating those rules, Fox affiliate KMSP in Minneapolis and South New Jersey NBC affiliate WMGM must each pay $4,000 for failing to identify the sources behind the segments. KMSP aired a report on increased consumer demand for convertible cars, sponsored by General Motors. WMGM aired a pitch for Zicam embedded in a story about treating the common cold. The FCC's action stemmed from a 2006 complaint filed by Free Press and the Center for Media and Democracy. Free Press attorney Corey Wright says that although the FCC's action was a long time coming, it's a welcome sign that the agency is paying attention to VNRs.
These are not trivial infractions. People go to their local television broadcasters to get important information about decision-making in their everyday lives, as well as more important things like health decisions or political decisions. When a station airs something that is actually a commercial masquerading as a newscast, that has really, really dire implications for an informed citizenry, for democracy, and for any number of things. But the bottom line is that people deserve to know when they're watching a commercial and when they're watching bona fide news.
The groups cited more than 100 instances of undisclosed VNRs. The FCC has now acted on 7. Wright says we shouldn't underestimate the message the industry is getting.
The fact is that the FCC did fine these stations. It shows that they're looking into it, and they're not going to let those complaints slide by, even though they may take a long time to act on them.
Ask a typical American what they know about Africa, and the typical response will include at least one of these: famine, war, and disease.
There's still a perception that Africa is a scary place, an unknown place full of rather alarming people. And for Westerners, it's always a big adventure to come here.
Journalist Karen Rothmeyer has lived in Kenya since 2007. She says the foreboding image of Africa is one that's been carefully groomed by charity groups and relief organizations. In a recent article for the Columbia Journalism Review, Rothmeyer argues that NGOs in the region push stories that amplify conflict and suffering to bolster their own work as they compete for funds. And U.S. reporters, with pressures to file stories quickly, take the bait and reflect a fearful portrait of Africa in their stories. Rothmeyer admits that when she first began reporting on Africa and other developing nations, she was susceptible to the same spin and failed to question NGOs' agendas.
When I look back now, I realize I think I, too, was very much part of that groupthink of assuming that NGOs stand for everything that's good and that people who come around representing NGOs, they are ultimately the most credible sources you could ask for. Where was our skepticism? Where was our sense of wanting to know what everybody's motives are?
This lack of depth in reporting leaves Americans with an incomplete view, Rothmeier says, and that leads to policy decisions on Capitol Hill that affect Africa. U.S. businesses are also wary of the region, which discourages economic investment.
The concern that I have is much more for how the U.S. is suffering from the poor reporting that it's getting on Africa than how Africa is suffering. Indians know this is a great place. They're rushing in here to spend billions of dollars on companies. South Africans know it's a great place. They're buying up companies here. Banks in Kenya are making money hand over fist. So it's America's loss not to have a better sense of what Africa is all about.
Rothmeier says journalists shouldn't ignore the human rights issues in Africa, but she suggests that reporters dig beyond negative stereotypes to offer a more genuine picture.
To people thinking about how to do a better job with regard to covering Africa or any of the developing countries, just think about it as you would think about Canada. Treat it in the same way. Realize that it's a complicated place, that there are lots of stories there, good, bad, funny stories, sad stories. There's not just one story of Africa. There are more than 50 countries here. There are 1 billion people here, and there are many, many stories to be told.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 this Sunday, April 3rd, 2011. Our guest today is the most recent winner of the Izzy Award for Outstanding Work by an Independent Journalist, joining the likes of Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill and Amy Goodman in its third year. And I have to confess, I am a judge for the Izzy Award, and one of the pleasures of my job is getting a chance to read huge stacks of clippings by prospective nominees, including our guest today, Robert Scheer, who probably needs no introduction to many of our listeners. He is the author of numerous books, including the most recent book by Nation Books, The Great American Stick Up, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street, published by Nation Books just a few months ago. He is also the editor-in-chief at Truthdig, formerly a longtime political reporter for the Los Angeles Times, going back from this decade into the 70s. And then for those of you of my generation, you'll recall him as editor-in-chief of Ramparts Magazine in the 1960s, one of the leading investigative and political journalists of that period. So it is a great honor to welcome today to Media Matters, Robert Scheer. Mr. Scheer, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing very well, and I think the first question I'd like...
By the way, I also teach at UCI in communications, where you're something of a legend.
Well, flattery will get you everywhere. Your resume is so long, we could do a whole show just going through your vita, so I left that out.
Okay.
And the one question I want to ask you, you're the first Izzy Award winner who actually... was around at the same time Izzy was still in his prime. Did you have any sort of relationship with I.F. Stone?
Yeah, I had a strap relationship. I would stand in the IRT train in New York, and when Izzy wrote for the old PM, the Compass, and he was a famous columnist, and so I knew him as a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, you know, it's interesting to get... I was actually the I.F. Stone Fellow at UC Berkeley's Journalism School, and I spent a few months thinking about Izzy again. And what was remarkable about him is that he really was not very ideological at all, very pragmatic, and he just read. He just did his homework. He just cared about facts and logic. He was not really politically driven very much. He just, he was a truth seeker. And I remember as a kid, you know, thinking, well, this is great journalism. So if I have any role model, it certainly was I.F. Stone.
Well, and I can say, having read your clips at length and your new book, that you follow, I think, very much in this tradition with your approach to facts and evidence and basically having a single standard for anyone in power, not a different set of standards depending on what party they're in or whether they're nice people or not.
Yeah, let me just say something about that. By the way, I am very optimistic about the Internet. I know a lot of people don't share that view, but I see Truthdig, which I now edit. I really don't run it. My 29-year-old son and then some 20-year-olds run it. But it's IF Stone on speed, or Ramparts on speed. And what I mean is, you know, with the links you can do, it's what makes Wikipedia so useful, all those links. And you can get up to speed very quickly. And what Izzy had to do, he had to go over to the Library of Congress and look for these volumes of hearings and turn dusty pages over and read all these things. Well, if I can get a student interested now in some subject, they can get up to speed in an hour or two. They can read original documents. They can read, you know, congressional hearing testimony, or they can view it on video. So I see the Internet as a great resource for revitalizing democracy. I'm very optimistic about the future of journalism. We haven't figured out how to make a living at it yet. But, you know, in terms of getting information, getting the word out there, we've had 50 million people visit Truthdig. I mean, that's mass media.
Yeah, Robert Scheer, for people who might not be familiar with Truthdig, tell folks, you know, what they would find if they were to go to that website.
Well, our idea was to use the Internet. I was still at the Los Angeles Times when I helped start Truthdig with my publisher, Wade Kaufman. She had worked with me on my columns. And so we were going to do it anyway, even if I wasn't pushed out of the L.A. Times. But a famous media critic, A.J. Liebling, once said, you know, freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one. And so thanks to the Internet, you don't have to have an awful lot of money to get started. You don't have to chop down a lot of trees and have contracts and, you know, for distribution and all that sort of thing. And so with a relatively small amount of capital, we launched Truthdig. We're not alone. There are many good Internet sites. But we set out with the idea that, A, we would pay for everything. We want to support journalism. And so we don't, you know, we're not primarily aggregators. We sponsor journalists, people like Chris Hedges, who was the New York Times bureau chief and who now is a regular every Monday on Truthdig. But we pay for AP. We pay for syndicated columns. We've sent three reporters to Iraq. We helped send someone to Afghanistan. So we try to support journalism. And what I did was, I think the smartest thing I did at the beginning, was I heard that my copy editor at the L.A. Times was taking early retirement. And I called him up. I don't know whether the guy's a Democrat or Republican to this day. And I said, Tom, I would like you. You're going to get very bored in retirement. Why don't you come and set the same standard for our publication here that you were doing at the Los Angeles Times, and that means you're going to check facts, you're going to make sure the headline matches the story, and we've been able to do that. He's now added four other people who are retired copy editors, and so they have the power 24/7 to pull anything off our page if they feel, you know, it's not holding up. And it's, as a result, we've won a lot of awards, and you know, we won the Webby three times for best political blog. We're getting an award this Thursday from the Society of Professional Journalists for taking the standards of old media into the world of the Internet. So that's really been our goal. Yes, we have a progressive vision, but we trust our columnists and journalists to amplify that vision. As they see it, we're not into censorship. We want it to be a broad site, and we have a good range of opinion. But in the main, we want it to be a reliable source of information. There's too much noise on the Internet, and we wanted to do journalism, just as I.F. Stone wanted to do journalism.
And Robert Scheer, you touched on the point earlier that how are we going to pay journalists on the Internet is sort of the great unanswered question, or still unresolved question. And you want to pay people at Truthdig. You do pay people. You have a lot of traffic at truthdig.com, apparently. And it is a wonderful site. It's well-edited. It's fact-checked. It's professional. But how are you able to raise the money to pay the bills?
Well, first of all, I don't take anything out of it, nor does my publisher. And, you know, we have to pay a living wage to the people who are doing the work. We have advertising revenue. Our readers support us to some degree. We're now playing with the idea or attempting to have a nonprofit wing where we can, you know, support a hybrid model. A lot of publications are moving to that, to do investigative journalism. So we're launching a journalism and mentoring project, because we want to bring along a new generation of journalists And to do that, I don't think we can rely on our for-profit model. I think we're going to have, as I say, a hybrid. But I think we're in a shakedown period. I am not. It's difficult to survive now for anyone. But one of the problems is that Google makes a lot of money off these ads, but they don't support journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Money is made on the internet, quite a bit of it. But it's not being channeled into journalism. We're still pretty much dependent upon the old mainstream print media for much of what's called news reporting. And so it's difficult, but I think we're in a shakedown period. Our readership is growing. We had a lively debate on our site about Huffington Post, AOL, and Chris Hedges wrote a scathing piece. And as I say, he's a regular on our site, attacking the merger and attacking the purchase of Huffington Post by AOL. I defended it. I think Ariana has been a good force on the internet. I think she's raised a lot of important issues. She's created a space where, the internet when she started was more right-wing dominated. She's created a space for more progressive journalism. Yet now it's up to Ariana and AOL to show that they will support journalism. And that means, W-2s. That means, sending people out and paying for their travel expense. And we'll see. But, if they want to get the traffic in the future, they're going to have to do that. And it can't come from the old line print organizations that are crumbling.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Robert Scheer, who you've just been listening to. Robert Scheer is the winner of the Izzy Award for Independent Journalism this year. Has a storied career as a journalist for the last 50 years in the United States. Going strong today as editor-in-chief and columnist, reporter for TruthDig at TruthDig.com, formerly with the Los Angeles Times, and before that, back in the 1960s as editor and reporter for Ramparts Magazine, the legendary magazine. We had Peter Richardson on talking about Ramparts a couple of years ago, and he had his book out about Ramparts, and you play a large role in that book, as I suspect you're aware.
Yeah.
Robert Scheer.
He's a good writer, Peter Richardson.
Yeah.
He really captured that magazine in a way that no one else has.
Yeah, it was a terrific book, and I enjoyed the show. Listeners wanting to call in to speak with Robert Scheer, our guest, the phone number here at Media Matters is 217-333-9455. We have a toll-free line, too, at 1-800-222-9455. And I would be remiss not to emphasize, your vita is so long, Bob, that it's easy to lose things, but you have this new book out, The Great American Stick-Up, published by Nation Books just a few months ago, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street. And as listeners to this show know, we talk about the coverage of the economy as one of the main themes of Media Matters, with different reporters and scholars, and we have lots of economists on the show over the course of the year. And this is really an excellent book. It's original material. It's great reporting. And the writing is it's lovely. I can see why Joan Didion has that nice blurb, because the quality of the writing is really
rare. Can I say something about that, because we tend to celebrate the old media too much, and what we're losing and blah, 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 And I, in my book, I covered this for the L.A. Times. I was a reporter and then a columnist when the radical deregulation was happening in the Clinton years. And the failure of the mainstream media to understand what was going on, to care, they mostly were cheerleaders, and that's the New York Times, the L.A. Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. They were cheerleaders for the dismantling of the New Deal, which is what happened, and created this enormous crisis of our country. It's a real betrayal of the great American dream. And it's interesting, I had interviewed Ronald Reagan when I was still at the L.A. Times, and I actually first interviewed Reagan when I was the editor of Ramparts, when he was running for governor, and I had a good relationship with him. I interviewed him when he was governor, before he was president. He was very generous with his time. And Reagan always said, he said this in his autobiography, he said that in his house, Franklin Roosevelt was a god, and no one criticized the New Deal. In fact, it was the New Deal that put food on the family table. And his own father, Ronald Reagan's father, went to work for the New Deal. And the idea that we entered a period where we systematically dismantled the safeguards put in by Roosevelt to prevent another depression, and to unleash the greed of Wall Street, which is really what happened, and not just with the reversal of Glass-Steagall, but the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which has hardly been noticed, that Bill Clinton signed off on in the last months of his administration when he was a lame duck, saying no regulation, no regulatory agency, no law would apply to these new financial gimmicks, these collateralized debt obligations that took, you know, the most sacred thing in America, people's homes, their homestead, their palace, and put it into some kind of security, some kind of junk bond and toxic, and sell it out there, and that would be totally unregulated. And that came about because Republicans in Congress teamed up with a Democratic president and did that. That's a story that the mass media missed in its basics, with very few exceptions. And so, you know, I'm not one of those who thinks, oh, you know, woe is us, you know, the good old days are gone. They weren't so good. You know, and we saw it with the coverage of war, peace issues. The mass media has been terrible. And certainly on basic economic issues. When I worked at the LA Times, there was occasionally a labor reporter, never two, just one, and one consumer reporter. And the rest of the way the economy was covered was by the business section, and the business section was sucking up to the big financial interests.
And in your book, you chronicle two things that you've already alluded to. One, that the Democratic Party, especially under the Clinton administration, was very much a driver of this deregulation and a dismantling of the New Deal era safeguards against speculation and financial overreach. And secondly, that the media, as you just said, really completely went along with it and cheer-led the whole process. And the other thing you haven't gotten to yet that comes out in the book that is that President Obama, when he was candidate Obama, at times there's a fairly sophisticated understanding of this whole process and what had to be done. But I don't get the sense from not only from your book, but from reading the newspapers and looking at the media today that President Obama in office has necessarily carried through with that critique and what he's done.
Well, Obama has been a great disappointment of my political life, I think. I mean, I really fell for him. I even contributed money. I don't know, I gave him $500 that I didn't really have easily 36 hours before the poll closed because some bundler down in San Diego told me, no, it wasn't in the bag, you know. And the reason I was so high on Obama is he gave a speech at Cooper Union in April of 08 when he was a candidate. And what he said is pretty much what I've said in my book, that, yes, you know, the Clinton administration, it was bipartisan, and it was the radical deregulation that unleashed the greed on Wall Street that caused all this misery. And then once he had defeated Hillary Clinton in the primaries, he turned to the veterans of the Clinton administration, you know, Lawrence Summers and the other acolytes of Robert Rubin, and, you know, they became his key advisors. Summers made over $8 million while he was an advisor to Obama in the 08 election. He got $4 million from the D. Shore Hedge Fund. He got $4 million from people like Goldman Sachs, you know, $135,000 for one 20-minute speech or something. You know, this is a form of bribery, but, you know, we don't see that. It's called speaking fees. By the way, it applies to some fancier journalists, too, you know, like Thomas Friedman and others getting enormous speaking fees. But, you know, here, you know, Obama just turned his back on his own wisdom and on the people who had been advising him in the campaign. And as we know, when he got into office, he picked Timothy Geithner, who was really carrying water for George W. Bush as head of the New York Fed, and he's the guy who presided over the AIG bailout and everything else. And then Lawrence Summers, Timothy Geithner was made his Secretary of Treasury. Lawrence Summers was brought in as a key White House advisor, and he turned to the foxes to guard the hen house, and it's really been despicable, and the pain out there. You know, this is what a lot of liberal people attack the Tea Party folks. At least the Tea Party are in touch. They point to the wrong enemy. They want to demonize immigrants and, you know, and let Wall Street off the hook. But at least they're in touch with the pain out there. I mean, we have, according to official census figures, 44 million people living under the poverty line, now the largest number we've ever had. And as a percentage, it takes us back to before Clinton was president. And that's under $20,400 a year for a family of four. We have 50 million Americans whose mortgages, they've either lost their home or their mortgages are deeply underwater. There's enormous suffering out there. That's why our politics are so unstable now. That's why we have this hunt for scapegoats, the demagoguing that's going on. And I think the Democrats have been incapable of responding to it because they're rallying around Obama, and Obama's in with Wall Street.
Robert Scheer, there was on the business page, I believe it was, of the New York Times. It might have been the front page on, I believe, Wednesday or Thursday, sometime middle to late last week. There were two stories next to each other that really captured what you were just talking about. On one hand, one story was about how wages are been so driven down by all the unemployment that now millions of Americans who are working can't barely pay any of their bills. The salaries are just so low at this point. And right next to it was a story about record bonuses for hedge fund managers. And several of these managers, even for hedge funds that weren't doing very well, made over $1 billion last year in income. And these are, with no sense of irony, these two stories are juxtaposed. But then what was most interesting was the following day, the same New York Times had its release of the job employment data. And there was sort of this celebration about 190,000 new jobs being created and all sorts of talk from Moody's experts about how we've turned the corner and the economy is about to kick into high gear. And this shows things are really whipping into shape. And it's, as I read your book, and I looked at these three stories last week preparing for the show, it seemed like our economics journalists don't ever seem to really see the big picture at all, do they?
No, but nor do the academics. I mean, look, first of all, economics is a profession. And that goes for the writers who write about the economy and were trained by the economists, became a servant of Wall Street, that we stopped thinking about economics in terms of economic history, sociology, philosophical questions or, what's right and wrong, even biblical assumptions or Aristotle or Confucius about, taking advantage of the poor and your obligation to the larger society. And instead, it all devoted itself to sort of the aura of science, mathematical model building that allowed the packaging of things and the selling of things that should not have been sold, the risk management and so forth. That's really what happened here. And that movie, Inside Job, that won the Academy Award, I think is excellent in that respect, exposing these people. And when you teach at a university, particularly one of the elite ones, I spoke at Harvard just a few months ago at the Kennedy Center. I asked them, how did you guys get to be such a den of iniquity? If you look at the mischief that has been done, it didn't. Obama talks about we have this big education problem. We do have a big education problem. We should pay teachers more and so forth. But the harm to our economy did not come from people who have low SAT scores or are struggling with their math. It came from people who won the Nobel Prize for their math and their economics. It came from the most elite top schools, Harvard Business School, Yale, and so forth. And these people have abandoned any sense of social responsibility, and it makes it's more effective to be a liberal or a Democrat because then you can gloss it over. You give money to the Harlem dance group, as Sandy Weill did or Robert Rubin. You're pro-choice, you seem kind of reasonable. But this applies to the journalists. If you play the game right and you're at least before the collapse of newspapers, you could make a very good living and you could be a pundit and get big speaking fees, we forgot the old motto, which is, the role of the journalist is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, to right the scales, to balance things. We don't have that anymore. Everyone's out for a career, their ambition, let the rest of society, suffer. And it's really a very frightening situation. In the universities, we teach careerism, we teach opportunism. How do you get ahead? We no longer in any serious way discuss, how do we make the society healthy? How do we help people? We've lost that. You're kind of a sucker if you do that, I have a son who teaches in Oakland in a high school, and when people say, "Well, where did he go wrong?" yes, he was a successful writing screenplays and everything. He thought this was more meaningful. Shouldn't he be able to buy a house? And now you make him the scapegoat. They're getting paid too much, and their pensions are too strong. I mean, there's something very ugly happening in this country, and we don't have a countervailing power. We no longer have labor unions of any significance. We don't have a consumer movement of any significance. They've been co-opted. Instead, you kind of have some feel-good companies like Google and Apple that at least are not the most offensive. But generally, people want to figure out how can they get theirs and step on everyone else on the way up. And, you know, these, look, the guy who was running our National Security Council for Obama was the guy who was the chief lobbyist for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for the last 4 years. Okay, and that's a company that pays people $5-10 million for screwing the rest of us. You know, well, look at all the veterans of Goldman Sachs and Citigroup that are in the Obama administration, and there's no shame. There's no concern about being accused of selling out. You know, no success, economic success is everything, and that's why they pay themselves these outrageous bonuses, and they're not feeling the pain of, you know, huge numbers of people out there. I mean, you lose your home, you got to put your kids out of school, you don't have the basis of your retirement, how are you going to help your family? You know, you lose all your worth. And now the fashion is to blame them. You know, blame the person who bought the house, you know, and not the banker who conned them into buying the house.
Yeah, there, you had a great line in your book, Bob Scheer, about that exact point about blaming the people who take out loans for the financial distress. And correct me, because I'm going to just paraphrase it. I'm doing it off the top of my head. It's like blaming the passengers on a discount airline if it's the pilot crashes the plane.
Right. You know, look, I mean, I ask my students, you know, because I hear this a lot. I hear it's a very convenient view. For instance, for faculty people, I've heard that on our own campus, you know, say, oh, you know, everybody was responsible. It was a perfect storm. I don't know if you have my book, but in the opening page of my book, George Bush is in the Oval Office, and he's there, you know, with his new secretary, Treasury Paulson, who had been head of Goldman Sachs, that did a lot of this packaging of these mortgages. And George Bush asked him, he said, how did this happen? You know, this is how the country is facing collapse. How did this happen? And Paulson said it's an embarrassing question to ask of someone from the financial community because we did it. Okay? There's no question. They did it. They did it by getting the laws changed with their lobbying efforts that were spending $300 million at a shot. You know, they did it by buying politicians of both parties. They got the radical deregulation, which, you know, they sought. And by the way, the word regulation is really a misnomer. It's sort of a license to steal is what you're really talking about. You know, it's you know, ending reasonable rules of the road. It's ending transparency. And so they got all of that, and they created this mess, and yet they can blame the victim. And I asked my students, I said, look, when you get a download a song from iTunes, every once in a while they say, do you agree to the contract? Do you actually read that contract? You know, and they'll all admit they don't, you know. Why? Because you assume there's some kind of regulation in place that Apple will not be ripping you off on that contract. And when people went in and signed 40 pages of a home document, they assumed that Wells Fargo or Bank of America were on the up and up. They didn't have to be lawyers. They didn't have to hire lawyers. They assumed that if this bank was giving them this wonderful deal, it makes sense. They didn't know that the bank had become something else. The bank was not going to hold this mortgage for 30 years. The bank didn't care whether the value was there. They didn't care whether you could make the payments. The bank was going to put it into some kind of security and sell it and be gone with it. And you were just fodder for their you know, activity. And so, you know, to blame the victims of this, these people in Riverside, California, or Florida, or Arizona, all over the country. And by the way, it's not just the people who got bad loans that are hurting. If you have houses being foreclosed on your block, you can own your house outright. You could have made every payment through your whole life, and your house is now worth, what, 50% of what it was before, okay? And try selling it. And yeah. So we penalized not just the people who got suckered into these loans. We penalized all homeowners. And the expectation now is that the value of housing in America will go down 10% over the next year. We've had the largest drop in new home sales since 1948. Housing is not being solved. We're not out of this mess. If you can't solve housing, you're not going to get consumption back. You're not going to get jobs back. 8.8% unemployment is hardly a victory. And a lot of it has to do with low-paid, as you indicate, low-paid salaries and people being brought back. And, you know, you've got auto workers now coming back and making $16 an hour, you know, desperate to get a job. And really can't support the family on that kind of wage, but it's better than nothing. And so, you know, this notion that somehow, you know, we're all this in together, it was a perfect storm, no one's responsible, is garbage. And the media has bought into it, has accepted that. You know, there's a blame to go around, you know. That was the position of Robert Rubin, and it's just a big lie.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, Robert Scheer, the legendary journalist, winner of the Izzy Award, currently the editor-in-chief at TruthDig, truthdig.com, formerly with the LA Times, and back in the 60s, the editor of Ramparts. It's a pleasure and an honor to have him with us. The phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting very patiently. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Savoy, you're on the air with Robert Scheer.
Well, thank you. You do keep people on a long time, much longer than Inge. So now I have three things to bring up instead of just the original one. Let me try to cover the new two very quickly so I can get to my main point. I do think we do need unions. I don't think I want to trust these other people to run things correctly and have zero unions. But unfortunately, I think we have a problem with having honest unions. I think we have a problem with unions electing the more intelligent members to run the unions. I think we have a problem with the unions protecting inadequate or lazy or dumb or whatever people, yet I don't want to give up unions, but something needs to be corrected there. Now, the bridge between that point and my third point will be, it sounds to me overall, as I think about these things and try to analyze what's going on, that children aren't being raised with something that we used to call a conscience. I would be willing to gamble now and say probably the lower classes are doing a better job of raising those children with a conscience than the upper classes, and the middle class is probably stuck somewhere in between. Anyway, that's just a little point of my own there. I wish to announce that to the public that might be listening that they need to realize that rules and regulations and laws are never going to replace morals and a good conscience. That's just never going to happen. And one of your points your guest made, I wish to elaborate upon, which is these laws are crafted in such a way that these people can go out and play their games. And somehow this just totally gets lost, and the media never picks up and talks about that. And that finally leads me into my original point. I would like to know what your guest was doing in the year 2003 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, if you could, please.
Well, I'll let my guest answer those questions, so at least the last one, and comment on the first part if you'd like, Bob Scheer.
I don't quite get that. What do you mean what I was doing in the years 2003 and 4? I mean whether I was covering what was happening?
I don't know if we still have the caller.
I
assume he's referring to possibly covering the financial crisis before this
crisis
hit. Oh,
I was covering the financial crisis before it was a financial crisis, but I wasn't alone. There was a wonderful woman named Brooksley Bourne, a lawyer, first woman to be editor of a major law school law review. She was at Stanford. She was a very successful Washington lawyer who actually represented banks and dealt with a lot with these collateralized debt obligations and all this stuff. And Bill Clinton, made her head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And in the mid-90s, Brooksley Bourne warned about all this. There were some people warned. Ed Markey, a congressman from Massachusetts, was quite critical. There were 8 Democratic senators who voted against the reversal of Glass-Steagall. There were people who were speaking out. They weren't listened to, and they weren't listened to by the leadership of either party. They were considered to be impediments to financial development and modernization and so forth. We'd listened to Brooksley Bourne instead of pushing her out, which is what Clinton did. We would have avoided this whole disaster. So let me just respond to the thrust of your call.
Sure.
Sure, we have a lot of problems. The labor unions could be better. Kids could be smarter. Global warming should be tamed. We have overpopulation. You go through the whole laundry list, and they're real issues. I'm not going to dismiss that. That's not what caused this financial meltdown. I call my book The Great American Stick-Up because it was a specific scam. It didn't really have anything to do with the history of capitalism. These devices, these toxic assets, would have been unimaginable to Adam Smith. They were actually unimaginable to Ronald Reagan. And this is a modern phenomenon. It was a scam. It was a hustle. If the mafia had done it, they'd all be in jail. You know, but the fact is these people are not going to jail because they get to write the laws. And so what we're really talking about here is not human nature.
It's not the long-run failures of our economy or our society. We're talking about what should have been judged a crime that was committed. The American people are paying for it. And the people who got to write the laws saying it's not really a crime, they're not suffering. They got the laws that they paid for, and they're going to get off the hook.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to line 4, Springfield. You're on the air with Robert Scheer.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Based on what Robert Scheer has said and written about the Clinton and Obama administrations, I would assume that he was not surprised by the appointment of Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson to chair the President's Deficit Commission, or I would also assume he was not surprised by the conclusions of that commission. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, it's business as usual, and it's not pointing a way out.
Okay, let's go to our next caller, which is, I believe, line 4, and that caller is from Urbana. Line 2, yes. Excuse me, Urbana, you're on the air with Robert Scheer.
Yes, I'd like Mr. Scheer to comment upon the way we compute unemployment today and have for about the last 30 years. There's a great deal of boasting about 8.8 unemployment, and it seems to me this is nowhere near the true unemployment.
Well,
it's probably closer to 17 or 18%.
Yeah.
Bob Scheer, go ahead.
Yeah, no, first of all, let me say 8.8%, the job creation that they're happy about, it would take us to the year 2017 to restore the jobs that have been lost. I mean, so let's be clear that even the claimed progress is quite depressing. I never thought that 8.8% official unemployment would be declared some kind of victory. It's appalling. When you consider the amount of money that was spent to make the banks whole, the debt, the loss of $13 trillion of value, the enormous investment, the Fed holding well over $1 trillion of the toxic assets they took off the bank and so forth, nothing done to help people with their mortgages in any serious way. So to get some very paltry improvement of the official labor figures after this enormous investment to make the banks whole, which is really what happened, and that shored up the stock market, that's a very depressing conclusion. That's a very high price to pay for jobs. If we had just had a program of hiring people to be school teaching aides, we would have been much better off. If we had just given firemen, policemen, and teachers a raise, we would have been much better off, you know, in terms of the multiplier effect. But I think your caller is absolutely right. We're now taking it as a victory if someone accepts a job way below their skill level, way below what they should have expected in the job market. So as you pointed out before, wage rates are declining, not increasing. And then, of course, you have the very large number of people who've given up looking for work. The much larger figure that should be in any serious employment figure. And actually, the New York Times, I've criticized the old media, but the New York Times on Friday had a very good story about, you know, how people are struggling and the suffering out there that is not in any serious way officially recorded. And, you know, anyone who teaches in college now or in high school knows that your graduates are looking at a pretty dismal job market. And so, yes, I mean, the caller is absolutely right. The official statistic, depressing as it is far too optimistic.
Our guest on Media Matters you've just been listening to is Robert Scheer, the award-winning journalist, many awards, most recently the Izzy, and currently the editor-in-chief of TruthDig at TruthDig.com, formerly for many decades with the Los Angeles Times, and before that in the 1960s, the editor of Ramparts Magazine, the iconic magazine of the 1960s. He's joining us live today on the phones. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And again, he is the author of the brand new book, The Great American Stick-Up, published by Nation Books late in 2010. Let's go to another caller right now. Line 1, Kankakee, you're on the air with Robert Scheer.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to get a sort of a longer view of your career. I just wanted to know what kind of motivated the early days, what, even before Ramparts, even, you know, back in your childhood or in your education, and to lead you to this. I think it's kind of something that's missing these days, and I'd like to know what it takes to cultivate it again. Thank you.
Well, that's a good question. You know, my father lost. I'm really an old guy. I'm going to be 75 tomorrow. You know, I can't even believe it myself.
You should celebrate this afternoon by going to a Lakers game.
I am going to a Lakers game as soon as you let me get off this phone. I got a ticket. But anyway, you know, my father lost his job the day I was born, and he was a machinist, in the garment industry, and my mother was a garment worker. They were immigrants. And, I had the same memory that Ronald Reagan had of, you know, if not for the New Deal, we were going to starve. There's no joke, you know, and my father didn't get his job back for 4 years. And he worked, you know, he was in the WPA and civilian kind of, he was a very proud craftsman, and he was very, you know, depressed about it. You know, my parents, let's say, were garment workers, so I know people can criticize unions, but if it wasn't minimal stuff they got from their union, they were really in being trouble. And I remember when my mother retired, she got a very small amount. I don't know, it was $80 a month pension. I wish she had been in the Teamsters or the United Auto Workers. Unfortunately, she was in the ILGW, so they had a very minor pension. And if not for me, my mother would have been a bad lady, you know. She couldn't live on what she had made after 40 years being in a factory, you know. So, you know, my view is people I'm writing for and the people I care for are the people like my parents. And, you know, and I have a sense of social justice that, you know, that you have to care about. And you know, my mother lived with me until she was 88, so she would remind me when she thought I was going off track or selling out or so forth. And so it was a good corrective. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, I'm really thrilled to be getting this I.F. Stone Award, the Izzy Award, because I.F. Stone was one of those honest journalists who inspired people like myself and set a very high standard. Murray Kempton was another. You know, there have been good journalists. Chris Hedges, who writes for Truthdig every Monday, is somebody who inspires me, you know, and make sure I don't want to sell out because Chris Hedges will denounce me. You know, so I think it's important though not to to remember who's out there. You know, that's really the important thing. I mean, I have to. One thing I like about journalism is being out there. You know, actually, whether you're talking about war and peace, I've covered war zones. I've seen people killed. You know, I had a lot to do with my attitude. So that's one of the reasons I'm very suspicious of military intervention, you know, and the claim you're helping people by killing them, because I've seen the consequences, obviously, as Chris Hedges has, you know. And in terms of these economic issues, I know what it does to a family to lose their home or lose their income, you know, so I just can't be indifferent to it. And it's a real problem, because what the society does is it co-opts you. You know, you get more affluent, you can be more comfortable. And so I think if not from my experience growing up and seeing what it really did to people to lose their job, you know, and how hard it was to make a living, I would have been on Wall Street and I'd be one of the scumbags that's messed up our economy so badly. But fortunately, I was able to avoid that.
Well, along the way of not going to Wall Street, you were at Ramparts in the 1960s, and really Ramparts was in the middle of a renaissance of investigative journalism during that era. And you teach students today, as I do, and my students have a lot of interest in that period. And I was wondering, you know, what do you think, if you, you know, when you're talking to students or anyone who ask you about that era, the Ramparts era, the 1960s, what do you think people today least understand about what it was really like then from your experience? I mean, what have we forgotten about the 1960s or not learned from it?
Well, we've made war into a video game, and you know, students don't have to face what students in the 60s faced, which is going down at a draft board. And your number may come up, and so it was not some, you know, chit-chat about war and peace, but you, in fact, were going to be made to sacrifice. And now war has been, you know, what they learned from Vietnam, and we saw it with both the Iraq wars, and we see it with Afghanistan, is they can market these things as no cost. Now, of course, we know there's real cost. We know human beings die and get injured, and the injuries are very severe. Ron Kovic, one of the people I most admire in life, who was wounded in Vietnam, visits. He's a patient in the veterans hospital, so he talks a lot and writes on Truthdig about, you know, the head injuries and all the damage. I'm not saying people aren't being killed and maimed in these wars, not just Americans, but of course people that we're supposed to be saving. But for average students now, war is not something that affects them. It's almost an entertainment. It's something you can watch on television if you choose to. So they've learned to make war very technological, for most people, bloodless. There's enormous costs involved. We spend more money per capita than we did at the height of the Cold War on this military. It's draining our economy. But they've been able to sanitize it. That, you know, remember, Bush wouldn't let you take pictures of the coffins coming back and so forth. So, you know, for me, Vietnam was visceral because I went there in 63-64 as a journalist. I saw what it does. You know, I made other trips to that area, you know, but even if you didn't go there and you were a kid sitting in Omaha someplace, you know, you had to face the prospect of being dragged off to that war, and you started to ask questions about what it was about. And they've been able to sanitize war in a way that makes it not any less lethal, but more palatable.
Well, Bob Scheer, we have a full bank of callers, and we've only got 9 minutes left. So this is going to be those express rounds, I guess, to do at the end of quiz shows or something. Let's see how many of these callers we can get through. Let's start with line 4, Peoria. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Robert Scheer.
Yeah, I'll do an express comment. I want to thank him for his work on ramparts, which kind of changed my life and maybe saved my life, as well as, and I'll just make a comment about the 60s, because I'm 65, retired from the Machinists Union, and where my pension was safe, wasn't in a 401k, and I also think the draft and when I went to school, if you flunked a class, you went to the Army, and the average stay was 275 days, I think. So you either got shot, killed, or, you know, it was hard for people to go through a whole year. And then the people who came back enlightened those of us who were still, getting our deferments. And the combination of the everybody going and the investigative journalists like ramparts made a difference in ending that war. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. Maybe let's go to our next caller, and we'll tag them together. Let's go to line 1 now. Savoy, you're on the air with Robert Scheer.
Thank you. I have a question and, if there's time, a brief comment. First of all, I would like to know if Robert Scheer was not editor or a reporter or feature writer for the New Times magazine?
Yes, I was, actually. Thanks for remembering it.
Yes, well, New Times kind of succeeded Ramparts, as far as I can remember. And well, I enjoyed reading New Times and your features for the brief lifetime of New Times. But I read in Dan Mulday's book called Dark Victory about the Reagan and the MCA connection. I read that MCA purchased New Times and then shut it down. And I was wondering if that wasn't a concerted right-wing effort to get rid of New Times by MCA.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Let's stop there and let Bob Scheer answer that question. Bob?
Well, actually, I don't know the details of how New Times ended, but I've been pushed out or fired from a number of places. I said before, freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one. You know, the founders of this country expected a free press, and they were willing to put up with a really vituperative, tough press that savaged them. But they assumed it would be available to just about any white male anyway. Yes, they had their blinders. But, you know, town crier, somebody putting up a poster, somebody putting out a pamphlet like Tom Paine, you didn't require any big capital. And what has happened is, over the years, of course, that media came to be another huge corporate center of profit, you know. And then one of the reasons why the media went so easy on this radical deregulation on the financial industry is they wanted it for communications. They were just companies like the others. And the Telecommunications Act was Bill Clinton's great gift to big media. and to the big corporations. And that's why the newspaper that I worked for 30 years went into bankruptcy. They became a victim of their own greed and, you know, the synergy and owning a television station and a newspaper in the same market and all that. And then the Tribune Company bought them. And then a guy like Sam Zell can buy the Tribune Company. And you're off to the races. And the races led, in this case, to bankruptcy. And so, you know, the media, the big media conglomerates, they're just businesses like anyone else. Sometimes they do a better job of it because they have some family ownership. And most of the time they do a worse job of it.
Let's go to our next caller now, line two, Chicago. You're on the air with Robert Scheer.
How you doing? First-time caller.
Oh, that's great. And call next week during the pledge drive and really show impress us.
Well, I'm a former journalist myself, and a lot of this resonates with me. And I will comment on broadcast journalism in particular, the broadcast media. Ralph Nader has said the airwaves are public property. We're the landlords. Why don't we collect the rent? And one of his favorite authors is a guy named Henry George. That's also one of my favorite authors. In fact, I work with an institution called the Henry George School in Chicago. Henry George said that basically the value of natural resources should be owned by the whole, it should be the commons. And his proposal was to collect the value of the natural resources, that's land, that's any kind of raw material resources. He died before radio, but he would have said the airwaves as well, and socialized that. He said to leave labor alone, don't tax them. That would have been kind of a totally monstrous idea to him. And he said don't tax capital goods that people have made. He was a big friend of the labor movement, and he sympathized with their goals, but he said that to organize a counter-monopoly in response to corporate monopolies was a bad idea. He would have gone with, for reasons that are way too deep for me to get into here, he said that basically we open up opportunity when we take the value of natural resources and we socialize it.
Yeah, we're really running low on time here. Can we sort of wrap this up quickly?
Sure. I just want to say that either of you heard of those ideas, and particularly with response to, with respect to, say, the broadcast of the spectrum that we all use, because...
Okay, that's a great question. Bob Scheer, are you familiar with Henry George?
Yeah, I'm familiar, and there's always been... There's a Henry George School in New York as well and other places, and this is part of the great tradition of questioning power, and it's a principle that has been endorsed throughout this country. I mean, the whole idea of stakeholders. And one reason we wanted housing to be available to people is we wanted them to be stakeholders, that it was a bedrock of a vibrant democracy. People had something, and that's why we gave a tax break on interest paid on housing. That's all been betrayed. It was betrayed in the name of deregulation, including communications and the airwaves. Deregulation meant let's give the big corporations and Wall Street a blank check. It was that simple. And transparency and accountability. Let them do what they want. That's called modernization, and we'll all benefit. And the fact is, we all got screwed.
Robert Scheer, I want to thank you for taking time the day before your birthday, just 35 minutes from tip-off for the Laker-Denver game, for joining us here in Media Matters today. It's been a real honor to have you on our show today.
Okay, I'll come back anytime you want.
Super. I'll take you up on it. You can count on it. Robert Scheer, the editor of TruthDig at TruthDig.com, the author of the new book, The Great American Stick-Up, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street, has been our guest today. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, and, of course, Melissa Trentz, my producer, for a great show. Every listener, please, 1 week from today, 167 hours from now, or 66 hours from now, whatever it is, we're going to have our Pledge Drive show, and we need your support more than ever this year. Please listen for next week. It's going to be a terrific show. We're going to be on the road in Boston. It should be a wonderful 2 hours, and make your pledge. Okay, thank you all, everyone. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for East Central Illinois, today partly sunny with a high near 73, but breezy with gusts up to 45 miles per hour. Tonight, a strong chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly after 1 a.m., with a low around 55. Monday, showers and thunderstorms, with a high near 57. Monday night, cloudy with a low around 33. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 54. And Tuesday,